This is the First Time Podcast.
Part reality series.
Part writer's masterclass. It's a podcast about the first time
you publish a book.
I'm Kate Mildenhall.
And I'm Catherine Collette. Welcome to the first time. The First Time Podcast has a newsletter. It will go out monthly-ish. To sign up, go to our website, thefirsttimepodcast.com, and click on the Sign Up to Our Newsletter link. Okay, Kate, have you ever had a mentor in life? Like an organic one?
An organic one. Yeah, I have. And what is so lovely is that this week we speak to Kelly Gardner, the writer, and she has kind of been my informal mentor.
So how did you meet Kelly?
So Kelly and I worked together at State Library, and I'm not sure that Kelly even knows this story, but like mortifyingly, I didn't realise that she was a writer. She was just this very, very switched on and impressive person who did all of the online stuff in the area that I worked. And it was when I was kind of starting to think about trying to write and when I realised I was mortified. And Cal has helped along the way in various things. She was the first person I sent my contract to when I got it and kind of said, and I think called her and said, Kelly, what am I supposed to do? Like, should I say yes to this? You know, what? So she's very, very smart. Yeah. And she's been a person that I can call on at different times.
So were you friends first?
Not really, not really.
Or you gravitated once you knew in some ways.
Yeah, that and I have just sometimes repaid with jam and chocolate, but mostly have gone on her extraordinary goodwill to just be able to help me out at various times. So I've had that kind of relationship. I've also done a formal mentorship. And I mean, I'd class a whole lot of my more experienced friends as mentors as well, in a way. What do you think? Have you had a writing mentor?
I haven't really had. Well, I have had. Yes, is the short answer.
Yeah. We don't like short answers on this show, Catherine.
No. I think mentoring's a funny thing. The first mentoring experience I had was run through. I was doing a learning development programmy thing through work, and they didn't assign you a mentor, but as part of it, you had to have a mentor.
Sure.
And so you got to approach someone and say, you know, would you be my mentor? And I approached someone, a guy who I thought would be wonderful. And it was just...
Why did you think he would be wonderful? Because of where he was at in his career?
He just seemed very approachable. I always thought that he was insightful and a really nice mix of... that he was very intelligent but also very people-oriented.
Sure.
Like, he just was a really nice mix. And I thought we would get along, but it just was the most dysfunctional. Well, it wasn't dysfunctional. It just was a very long, awkward experience. So we would meet for breakfast once a month at this terrible cafe. And, yeah, it was just a – it kind of turned me off. That non-organic mentor, that formal mentor process where you ask someone to be a mentor,
yeah.
and
sure,
you know, it really turned me off that.
Well, because I think that what you need are parameters, and I think that that's what was amazing. What I was actually looking for when I went about organizing my formal mentorship, which I did with Charlotte Wood, is that I felt terrible that I was doing all this asking questions of people and there wasn't a payment system and I didn't know how I could ever repay the time and energy except
yes.
for passing it on, which is what people say, but like, how will you ever be as good as they were to
yes.
you? You know? So
well,
it has
an arc, because that initial period you are so much more in the role of recipient.
Absolutely.
Than in the role of giver.
Yeah.
And it's a much more comfortable thing to be a giver than a receiver.
Yes. But I suppose what I loved, and in the initial kind of application process to Charlotte and the back and fro about whether or not, you know, she would be able to mentor me, if we'd be a good fit, if it was appropriate. She really lays out what the parameters are. And I love that. I love that.
It's interesting. You raved so much about Charlotte that then I applied
yes.
to have Charlotte as a mentor.
Yeah.
So we had a shortened mentoring period and she was fabulous. She gave me the most insight of in a really, really short space of time. It's just unfortunate that we were meant to pick back up this year and she's too busy.
I know, because she's about to have her come out. We will be talking to her later this year before that happens. I think the structure of the timing, so the way that mentorship worked was a weekly check-in and then a monthly Skype call over 6 months. Although we had some breaks in there as well, so picked it back up. And I have then had ongoing sessions where I've checked back in with Charlotte as well. And I think the really key thing about that mentorship is that it's not about the manuscript.
She doesn't read it.
She reads a sample when you apply to see if, you know, you're kind of going to be able to work together, I suppose. And then she doesn't read it. So it's like writing therapy.
I completely agree.
Yeah, about your character or about endings or, you know.
Well, it's like therapy about where you are at in a mental sense. But you also have this incredibly, you can't really talk to someone else in that level of detail of, oh, this one character, you know, I just can't decide if they should do this or if they should do this. And that's very hard to explain to someone.
Yes.
But the beauty of having explained it to someone over a period of time is that you can convey the conundrum that you're having.
Absolutely.
At a really micro level.
At a really micro level. So I think for the work, and, you know, I actually went on to have Charlotte assess my manuscript and talk about it because she kind of knew the material and the genesis of it so well. And that has been a fabulous experience as well. So that there's that technical aspect of dealing with the work and the problems you're having with the work, but also this other arc, which is kind of your career arc or who you are as a writer. And I should note that the period through which Charlotte was mentoring me through, I had a few pretty big professional and personal hurdles during that time. And so having her be able to work with me through some of that stuff, the professional stuff mostly, about, you know, how to come back from feelings of failure and rejection, how to deal with certain types of criticism of the work. Like, it was just perfectly timed. I don't actually think that I would have been able to finish the project as I did. And I think that my writing process has changed at the end of it as well.
How would you say it's changed?
I think the way that I conceive of it, I think Charlotte's ability to look back and say, this is where you are in this very early part of your career. And I used to be like that too. Some of the angst about writing, some of the parts of writing that we give a lot of energy to, which do not serve the writing in the end, working out how to balance writing and life and social media and other aspects of it, all that kind of stuff, has been extraordinarily useful. And things like the checking in that I did on a weekly basis with her and some of the questions she asked, I still do those questions. And when I'm stuck, I go back to the original material that we talked about and use that too.
And you have also done mentoring of other people through like Writer's Vic and those sorts of things, haven't you?
Yeah, I have. So not on those kind of long-term mentorship things. But I really enjoyed the process. And I think too, like, I'm beginning to be able to give back a little when people, you know, ask, can you read something for me or can you have a look at my contract or can you talk me through this thing that's happening to me? Like, I've been approached by someone and can you talk me through? So I feel like I'm just starting to be able to give back a little bit in that way. And it's something that I would love to get into. You know, I'm a teacher by trade. I love talking with people about process and watching growth and helping people reflect on what they're doing and goal setting and that kind of stuff. But having worked with Charlotte, I'm also like, you know what, in 5 more books or in 15 years, I'll be ready to actually be more useful in that.
What she really,
how
she works with you, which is born from a long experience in
having done it herself. Do you think that you will, that you would like to mentor?
As a female in science, engineering, maths sort of thing, you get asked to mentor a lot.
Yeah, I can imagine you would.
I've never done it. Like, I just feel like I've never really been in a position to do it. I was probably too green for a long time.
Yeah.
And now I do have more experience, but I have less time. So I think I will at a point in time. I think you have to be at a point that you – that's the beauty of Charlotte. She has something to say.
Yeah.
I think sometimes people – like, I think – people want to help, more people want to help other people than want to be helped.
Yeah,
so
that's
it's
interesting.
Like, I think you have to have something to offer.
Yeah.
And I think sometimes that comes, you know, it takes time
to
have that.
And I think you can do it in baby steps too. There's a great thing that came out maybe just recently. We'll link to it. Toni Jordan writing for Writers Vic. And it just really stuck out to me what she said, that once you're past being an emerging writer, it's your responsibility, she said.
I agree with that.
To, you know, to help up those. And all of those images we've got at the moment about leaving the door open behind you and putting the ladder down and the rest of it. And I think so that baby steps of going, well, what I can do is do an intro email.
That's
true. Or what I can do is, you know, do a reading for you, you know, do a beta reading if I've got time. And, you know, or what I can do is let's meet up and have a coffee. And I know there's lots of things we can talk about meeting up and have a coffee because you're not getting the writing done. And as Catherine Devaney would say, you can meet up and have coffee with writers all week, but there is no writing at the end of the week. But I do think that people can give you spot on advice at different times that can really help you push forward.
Yes. I don't know if I'd call it mentoring.
Well, yeah,
but
that's
it's
true.
Help. Yeah.
Yeah, that's
I think
true.
It's, I do think
maybe
that
it's
that
writing community.
Important. Yeah, I do think that sense of reciprocity because people have helped me that I do feel.
And you know what I think too, just to on the semantics of mentoring, that people who are not in a workplace, and this is why maybe I see it as mentoring and you don't, because you're in a workplace at the moment, separate to your writing, with lots of those structures around it. And I think that writers who are out in the world wandering around as I am now, also desperately searching for some of those structures that you get in a workplace, professional development, career advice, you know, those structures.
You are much more of a Lone Ranger.
I'm a Lone Ranger at the moment. Mm. But you know what? Happy to be Lone Ranger with all of our Lone Ranger listeners out there.
Sounds like it's taken a turn for a you know, love, Lavorn.
I feel like we could kind of do that. I feel like this is a different time. We're recording this at a different time and it feels like kind of a late night radio session. Okay, stop. We've talked a lot today. That's the end.
That's it.
We love you. Thanks for listening. This week I have the utter privilege of chatting to a mentor of mine, Kelly Gardner, writer and educator, who talks about getting the writing done, about expectation management, and above all things, about lady pirates. Kelly Gardner is a writer, editor, and educator. Her latest book is Brimstone, the first in her Firewatcher Chronicles for middle grade readers. Her previous novel, 1917, was shortlisted for the New South Wales Premier's Young People's History Prize. Kelly's other books include Act of Faith and The Sultan's Eyes, both of which were shortlisted for the New South Wales Premier's Literary Awards, and Goddess, based on the life of the 17th century French swordswoman Mademoiselle de Maupin.
Maupin,
thank you. Kelly teaches creative and professional writing at La Trobe University and is the co-host of Unladylike, a podcast about women and writing. Thank you for coming to speak to us, Kelly.
That's a pleasure.
I should also say that Kelly is an extraordinarily generous mentor who has answered many questions from me, including, Kelly, what is this contract? Please help me for my very first book. And Kelly, can you please teach us to podcast? So,
It's all my fault.
It's all your fault, and it feels delightful, delightfully inevitable, as Davina Bell would say, to have you in the seat. We are going to begin, as we do with everyone, with your first time you saw your words in print. Can you tell us about it, please?
The very first time would have been, and I can't really remember it, but it's come back to me recently to haunt me. I had a little story in our high school magazine, which was like an annual book.
Yeah.
And I'd forgotten all about it, but I recently had my, I won't say how many, reunion.
Did someone remember it?
And somebody, they remembered a whole lot of things, but they actually posted a whole lot of images from the book on Facebook. And there it was.
Oh, I love this.
And it was just this terrible sort of angsty, well, actually it wasn't that bad, but it was just the, you know, the feeling, the teenage feeling.
There's so many feelings.
My God, I can't even remember what it was about now, but it was very angst-ridden.
Can you remember at all? So you've got this feeling of looking back at it. Did you want to be a writer back then? Was that what you were passionate about?
Yes, I always did. Well, I wanted to be an archaeologist first.
Yeah.
And then when I got in, by the time I got into high school, I knew I wanted to be a writer. So by the time I was finishing high school, which would have been then, I was pretty sure. And then I went from high school straight into what was then, because I'm pretty old, what was then the first, one of the first writing courses in the state.
And what was that like? Who was in it? What did, how has it changed? You teach in a writing course now. Like, what's the difference in writing courses? What was that first one
Well, actually, I was just thinking about this the other day, because what I was thinking about was that it was a totally integrated literary studies and professional writing course. And I was thinking about how you can't do writing really unless you understand, or editing and publishing, unless you understand how texts work. And so that grounding of, I don't know, mostly literature subjects plus writing subjects was actually perfect for me. And there's a whole lot of stuff that we studied then in things like Elements of English, where we learned how Middle English and Old English worked and the building blocks of language that I've never forgotten.
Mm.
And the other thing for me in that course, it was at what was then called Paran CAE, which became, I took so long to finish, it became Deakin University.
As we
University.
All do.
But it was Paran CAE and they had a priority for mature age students.
Okay.
And so my memory of it is that there were only two of us who were straight out of school, me and Rosie Firkin. And I've never seen her since. Oh. And so that was amazing because I was only 17 and everybody else was like 30s and over.
Wow. So what were you writing then, Cal? What, like, you went into that course and what did you want to create?
I thought I would be the next Hemingway.
Excellent. Start small.
Start small. And I really thought I would have won the Nobel Prize by now.
Obviously.
Yeah. But then I got there and everybody else thought they were Hemingway as well.
As they all still do. As
and
we
they
all
were
still
wrong.
Do.
We were all wrong. But that's okay. So I think, I mean, one of the things was I came from a working class family and I was the first in my family to finish high school and the first one to go to university, not because anybody couldn't. I mean, they could have if they had been able to. They were much brainier than me, but they all left to get jobs. Yeah. So I, like many of the people I teach now, had no expectations of what university would be like. And I, when I think back on it now, I remember all the teachers and the subjects that we did very fondly. But I remember this group of people who were just, you know, some of them were drug addicts. Some of them were single mums with three kids. Some of them were people who wanted to write their whole lives and were just coming back to it. People were poets, beat poets, like really thought they were Jack Kerouac.
Yeah, wow.
And I'd never met anybody at all like that. And they were writing out of this incredible life experience, of course, that I was 17 and nothing had ever happened to me.
So did you then take that much needed break to go out and do the world in all its glory before you came back to finally publish your first book? How did that happen?
That, it would be good if that sounded like a strategy. And I do actually remember a moment sitting on a picnic table. I was away for the weekend with some friends and I was reading Simone de Beauvoir. And there was this, I don't even remember which book it was, but she said, I couldn't write yet because I had to live for a while. And I distinctly remember thinking, ah, yes, okay, I need to do that. So I could pretend that I had a strategy, but actually what happened was I got involved in student politics and got carried away and just dropped out of university. And then later on, I realised how I had this only tiny little amount to finish. And so I went back and by then I was a mature age student. I don't know, maybe, I think it was just before the statute of limitations kicked in. So
yeah,
it must
right.
have been like 9 years later.
Yeah.
And by then I was, you know, all of 30 or something. No, the maths doesn't add up. I can't remember. Anyway, I was mature age. Everybody else was young. And it had completely
shifted
around. And I really enjoyed that because I was much more confident. Like when I was an undergrad, I never said a word in class or anything. I just sat there open-mouthed listening. But by then, you know, I was an old season student union campaigner and I could talk to crowds of thousands. So talking in class didn't matter. And then I went straight on to do my master's then with the beautiful, dear departed Judith Rodriguez.
Mm. So tell me then, Your first book that's published is Swashbuckler.
Ocean Without End.
Ocean Without End in the Swashbuckler trilogy. That's in 2006. So how did that come to be?
The book?
Yes.
So I was living in New Zealand then.
Yeah.
And I had started writing the book. And it's a middle grade book for 8 to 12 year olds, about a girl pirate. So there's lots of sailing around.
All our favourite things.
Yeah. And I'd started to write the book and we were living in town in Auckland, and one day my partner said, I think we should just go out to this island and have a little look. And so she took me out there, and she'd arranged to have an inspection of this beautiful little mud brick house on the island.
That you knew nothing about?
I knew nothing about it. And we got there and looked around. It was absolutely gorgeous, and there was a moorpork in the tree. And she said, okay, well, I think we should come and live here and you should write a book.
Oh, my goodness. I did not know that story.
Yeah. So she basically tricked me into living on an island. And and I was working in town, and we just commuted every day. And so we were out on the water every single day. And that alone helped so much with writing the book.
Absolutely.
But then, yeah, so I finished the first book, and I did all the research about what you do and pitch letters and sending it off and how long you have to wait and who to send it to. And I decided that HarperCollins in New Zealand would be my ideal publisher, because they were publishing Margaret Mahi and various other people then at that time. And I sent it off, and I put in my diary 3 months later to ring them up, just like you do. And then 3 months later to the day, I went into a meeting room at work and I rang up the publisher, Lorraine Day, and said, oh, hello, my name's Kelly Gardner, and I wondered if I could talk to you about my pirate book. And she said, oh, hello, Kelly Gardner, I would love to talk to you about my pirate book.
Oh, my goodness. I love that.
So, you know, I know that never happens.
No.
But it happened to me.
It happened to you.
And so they loved it, and I hadn't at that point. I think I'd started the second one, but I was kind of waiting.
But you had it mapped in your head.
Most of it mapped in my head. And so they signed the three books, and then I decided. I didn't totally give up my day job, but I gave up my full-time day job.
Yep.
And so I was working part-time, but it was this fantastic gig. I was editing a small farming magazine. And so I did that for 2 weeks, and then I wrote on the island for 2 weeks.
But that worked, obviously, to immerse yourself for that 2 weeks. Right, then go and do another job.
Oh, it's the best thing.
And that's how you've continued to work?
No. I wish every gig was like that, because you get this concentrated writer's residency time. And then by the time it's over, you're really ready to go and talk to people and go to a restaurant for lunch or, you know, be in an office and do something different.
Be in the actual world.
So, you know, if you can find a gig like that, fantastic.
So you published the books. What did it, do you remember what it was like seeing them out in the world for the first time?
Yes. I, like everybody, thought that they were going to go sell millions all over the world.
Yep.
And do you know what? They didn't. But the publishers were so kind. And one of the things I will say about writing for kids and young adults is that there are these incredible communities that already exist. And so the publishers were fantastic. They introduced me to everybody. You know, I remember it was Margaret Mahi's 70th birthday, and they threw a big party for her, a big dinner. And, you know, they invited me, and I sat at the table with Tessa Duda.
Wow.
And I just thought, you know,
this is it.
This is it.
This is the pinnacle.
I'm peaking too early. And indeed I was. And that is one of the most amazing things, I think, about writing in those communities, is that, you know, they exist. They're very welcoming. They're very supportive. People are just so excited to hear about you. You know, I could have a long, long chat with Margaret Mahi about women pirates, which, of course, she knew all about.
Were you part of any of those networks already? You were editing. Like, were you part of any of the?
No.
Because now I see you. I mean, I see Kelly Gardner as so integral in lots of those communities, but that was your first foray into it.
It was. And one of the tricky things for me has been that I'm Australian, and then I was living in New Zealand and published in New Zealand. So, for example, those books didn't do great here because everybody thought I was from New Zealand. whereas all the New Zealanders thought I was Australian.
Yeah, right.
And so when eventually I decided, that was one of the reasons eventually that I decided I had to move back, because I couldn't, I mean, I love that community in New Zealand. It's really, really strong, and the festivals are great, and the Storylines Foundation is amazing. But I was homesick. But B, I just felt like I couldn't, I needed to be here to be part of these communities, and I basically had to bust my way in here.
What does busting your way in look like?
It's really scary for an introvert like me. And because it doesn't really matter how welcoming people are, if you don't know anybody, you still have to kind of make your way. But one of the good things for me, I think, is when I did move back to Australia, I moved back to Melbourne and I started work doing completely different things at the State Library. And because the State Library has a community of young adult authors and people around it. And the next books that I was writing at that point were young adult and kids programming happening all the time. I mean, I just, you know, could be around. I had to be careful, very careful about managing my professional State Library profile and not mixing it up. But I could do things like volunteer at the Children's Book Festival.
Yes.
You know, that kind of stuff, and be there. You know, I could go to the Wheeler Centre after work and just listen to people talk.
You wrote then Act of Faith and Sultan's Eyes, the YA books, which were highly awarded, and then you wrote an adult book. For someone who is so deeply in that world of writing for children, writing for younger readers, what was that like doing the shift with Goddess?
Well, one of the things that kids and YA authors always get from people who are not kids or YA authors is, when are you going to write a real book? And so part of me just wants to go, you know, never, because I am.
Already.
Yeah. But I just really, really wanted to tell this story, and it's the story of a sort of 17th century swordswoman and opera star, and she'd been nagging at me for years, and I knew that it had to be an adult book, because I always knew that she was going to be telling the story from her deathbed, and it can't really work for young adults. I mean, you could kind of make it work for young adults, but that was forcing it. So for me, in terms of the writing, it was easy. I mean, it
just
wasn't easy to write
process.
It, but yeah, it was. But the thing about that process is, it was a PhD novel, and my research process was completely different. And so the process around producing it was different, but that's not because it was for adults. But then it became very obvious that there are literary communities around adult fiction, of course. And there are circles of people that I've contacted since, but it's not quite the same thing. I mean, it's a whole lot bigger for a start, and there's just lots of different people doing different things, you know. So it's not quite as simple. Not that it's never simple.
There's not the straight steps into it that you know through your connections in writing for children, etc., that you would follow into that world.
All those communities are very diverse and have lots of subsections and lots of different genre sort of groupings within them, and especially here, because there's stacks and stacks of people involved. Yeah, but I just did notice that it wasn't, like, in kids and YA, even if you don't know somebody, you will promote their book when it comes out. Well, I don't really see that as much among adult authors. I don't know why.
That's interesting. You, in your time teaching and working with writers, I know that you've done courses on social media and online presence. What are the expectations, or what's the minimum kind of way that a writer should interact in the online space, do you think, Kelly Gardner?
Well, I mean, I've seen people say that their publishers just expect them to be on social media now, and that's interesting, but it's not easy for people. But one thing I would say is that there is no better professional development tool and professional networking tool, especially for introverts, which most of us are, than Twitter especially, because the networks are there. You can talk to people that you've never met. You can talk to people that you admire. You can, and if you build up that, I don't think of it as a platform. I just think of it as a, you know, a group of people who will then back you up when you need them. If you're getting trolled, they'll back you up. But most importantly, when you've got something you want to promote, they'll back you up.
Mm. I read an article on the train on the way in here today about deep work, the New Yorker article, and, you know, getting off social media entirely. How do you balance doing your writing and your work with managing social media stuff, updating your blog, with your research things, which you do, which I know people look at and go to look at as well? How do you manage?
I better do it.
But how do you manage those two different states of work, I suppose?
It'll depend. So I often try to do my big writing, my fast drafting in blocks if I can get a residency or something, or if not, just lock myself away. So when I'm doing that, I don't do anything else. Like I use Chrome Nanny and I lock myself out of my browser or out of certain websites.
And do you do that? Sorry, look at me getting it by the minute. This is what I do with Kelly.
So this is how I do it.
Yep.
On those sorts of days, or even if it's a writing day, like, you know, my writing days are Monday and Friday at the moment. I've got it preset so that it doesn't let me look at certain websites between 10 and 12 and then between 2 and 4, say. So I've got two 2-hour blocks in a day, and I call them, I can't remember who told me this. I think it might have been the Thinkwell people. When I was doing my PhD, they did this thing about 2 golden hours. So you block 2 golden hours into your diary and it is immovable. And in those 2 hours, you don't do any research. This is especially when you're drafting. You don't do any research. You don't stop and look anything up. You don't look at your email. You don't answer the phone. You don't go make a cup of coffee. You just write. And for me in that, what I do is I do 25-minute blocks. So I do 25-minute sort of writing sprint, if you like.
Yep.
And then in the 5 minutes gap in between them, I might need to look something up, especially if it's a little thing that's, you know, I can't go any further unless I have to check, you know, what's the weather in France at that time of year or something like that.
Yeah.
So I do 25-minute sprints for 2 hours. And then if I want to, I just keep going. But I've got that at least that minimum of those two 2-hour blocks in a day, in a writing day. When I'm on a residency, I will write nonstop for 8 hours.
And then you said before fast draft. Is your process to go forward the whole time with that until you get to the end of it and then go back and see what you've got? Or do you look at it and move things around as you're going with that fast draft?
A bit of both. When I'm in that mode, I would just keep going. But then I get to a point where my brain can't handle it and I need to print it out and read it and look at it all again and then start again. And sometimes that will be because I've lost the plot, literally. Other times it'll just be I get to the point where I go, okay, that's a good benchmark. I'll just stop there. 30,000 words or whatever, and I need to read it to get my next momentum.
Kel, you've talked about, and I won't quote you directly, but I've seen it somewhere, you talk about walking the ground when you do research. So you go and visit the places that you're writing about. Do you like to do that all in advance, big chunky research, get it all down and wait till you kind of settled on it before you start writing? Or do you keep going back to do your research?
It depends where it is. Yep. If I can, I think it would be a mistake to do it all at the start. I think you have to do a certain amount of immersive research to know what you're looking at and what to ask, especially if it's somewhere it's like on the other side of the world, you might only get one chance. So you do as much research and ask as many questions as you possibly can before you go. You might even have written a bit. And certainly with Goddess, I'd written a fair bit before I'd been to Paris before, but I hadn't been to Versailles, for example. A lot of it's set there. So I'd written a fair bit and then I knew exactly what I needed to know, but not completely, because there are things that change totally when you get there and you see how far, for example, one place is from another place. But with these current books, Firewatcher, which are set in London over various periods, they're all set in the Blitz plus another time because it's a time slip. And so I've been to London so many times in the last few years for other things, and every single time I do exactly the same thing. I go to the same places over and over, and every single time I have different questions because I'm looking at it through one time it's the Great Fire of London, another time it's Viking Saxon London, which was in a completely different place. Yep. And this last time, which was just a couple of weeks ago, I was looking for Rome in London. And I've done a lot of that Roman stuff before, but this time I went to Colchester and Norwich to try and understand Boudicca's England.
Okay.
More. And I couldn't have done that before. It just felt like a gap, and I actually didn't know how that book was going to end. I didn't know what to do, all sorts of things, until I got walking the ground.
At the moment too, so you've got the Firewatcher Chronicles, which are coming out over the next 1 year? The next two come out of next 1-2 years? Look at me. Come on,
18
Cal.
Months.
Okay, 18 months. And you're also working on you've been working for a long period on another project, your Grace project.
Yep.
Are we allowed to talk about that?
Yes, we can talk about that. And also I've got another one which is about two young women who become bushrangers.
And bushrangers. So how do you divvy up your time and energy on those three projects that are all kind of going simultaneously? Is it by deadline in terms of what your agent or publisher wants? Is it where you are?
Oh, and another one which is set in apartheid South Africa.
Kelly, you put us all to shame.
Well, so it depends. So I did sit down. So Grace, which is about the pirate Grace O'Malley and Elizabeth I, that's done. You know, so I've been working on that for quite a few years.
Yeah.
But I did at one point, I can't remember, it might have been early last year or late the year before, I actually sat down with my agents and said, okay, here's what we've got going. What do you want me to do first? Because I don't care in that sense. Oh, like I had a few things I didn't care. With others, they will be, say a residency will come up and I think, oh, what's something I could really use the time?
Yeah, right.
So the bushrangers, for example, I had written one short story and half of another one, and I just wanted to keep going with those characters because they just made me laugh so much.
Yep.
And then this residency came up at Falls Creek.
That's right. I remember your pictures.
And so I thought I don't know what's going to happen in this story, but, you know, I can take them up into the high country. That would be fantastic. And I could go up there and that would be perfect. And so then I just thought, well, I'm just going to concentrate on them. So I did a whole lot of research for that project before I went up, and then I drafted. Whereas Firewatcher is different because actually what happened with that was I wrote that ages ago, the first book, and Time Slip was really unpopular at that time. So nobody wanted it. No, we don't know Time Slip. That was like the thing I wrote after the Swashbuckler.
Yeah, right.
And so when I had that meeting with my agents, I said, this middle grade novel in the drawer, do you want to have a look? And I sent it to them, and then, you know, 2 days later they said, right, we're pitching this on Monday.
Wow.
And then it sold straight away. So that was funny because then I had to go back to that and try and remember what my long-term plotting had been and the research.
So many interesting things about that. One of them is that you are now represented by Jacinta Tomasi and Danielle Binks. How has the process changed for you now that you have agents on board from when you didn't? What led you to that moment?
So when I first did the thing with HarperCollins in New Zealand, I didn't have an agent. But then when they said, yes, we'd love to sign you for 3 books, I thought, okay, I think I need an agent because I don't even know what a contract looks like.
Yep.
So I got in touch with the Agents Guild there, and my first agent then was Glenys Bean, who was then the president of that guild, very experienced. And so she negotiated that. So I just went and said, you know, I've got an offer and a contract. Can you look at it for me? And so she did the negotiations of those. And then I moved back here, and for a few years I thought, well, I think I don't need an agent because I saw what Glenys did and I've got my old contracts and I'll just make it the same as those ones.
Yeah.
And so I did that for 3 books.
Yep.
And I felt I'm no good at negotiating money, but when it comes down to it, especially if I can do it by email and I don't have to talk to a real person, I can do, you know, one percentage here or there.
Yes.
I can do that. And I just tried to make it match up with what she had done. But then when Goddess came out and there was a review in the New York Times, I started getting emails from people who said they were movie producers. And so I thought, I know this is
above and beyond. Yeah, what I can do.
So I got in touch with Jacinta then. And so then, and I'm very happy to have them now. And it is a huge relief not to have to think about it. And of course, they are much more expert at me and, than me, and they can negotiate better than me. Of course they can.
And that sounds like a pretty lovely conversation to be able to have for someone who is as experienced in you and has numerous projects that they could kind of pick out and work on, is to say exactly that. Well, what should I do next? Like, rather than sitting here in the angst of whichever project, you know, I comes up in my brain next, just tell me what to do and I'll do that one.
Yeah.
That sounds like...
And, you know, if they'd said something outrageous, could you do
yeah.
something you haven't even thought of, I would have said, nah, I got enough going on. But they wouldn't do that.
Yeah. You know. Agents in that sense, and your first as well, act as in a kind of a mentoring role. And I mentioned at the start how delightfully you have mentored me informally. Who has helped you? Who else has helped you along the way? Who have you sought out to help you in this book writing life?
I didn't really have anybody to mentor me at the beginning, but there were so many web resources around. I felt like I'd crammed my head full of stuff. I mean, what I will say is I did just what other people do, which is worry more about publishing than about finishing the book, which, you know, advice, don't do that, just finish the book. But you can't help get, you know, it's human to get obsessed about all of that and worry about it because you've never done it before. But then when I did have Glenys as my mentor and I had all those people around, I felt like I didn't really have anybody who sat down and mentored me in terms of writing. But I had had Judith Rodriguez when I did my master's, and she was a rather absent-minded supervisor, but just the most inspiring person to be around. Like, she would always turn up an hour late, and then but then she would appear with arms full of books, and she'll say, "Oh, what are you doing here?" And then she'd just fill my arms with other books and ideas, and absolutely brilliant. And so she stayed a mentor to me. I always knew that if I needed somebody, she was there. And yeah. We launched the second pirate book in Melbourne and she launched it, for example. Mm. And she always came to my launches. In fact, I was just thinking just before she died, oh, that's the first one of my launches that she hasn't come to. So there are people like that, that even if you're not sitting down with them once a month, you know they're there in the world, and you know that if you need them, they're there. Mm. But then later when I was, I mean, part of the point of doing a PhD is that you have structural
yep.
mentors. So I had Catherine Padmore particularly at La Trobe, and being in that environment of, you know, I could pick anybody's brains. There's a historian there, Paul Salzman. I could pick his brains about,
yep.
he was my co-supervisor, about historical early modern things. And there were other people doing their PhDs there who I'm still friends with, like Patty O'Reilly and Frank Cusworth. So and that was the first time I shared a draft of the novel with them. We all swapped, and that's the first time I'd ever done that.
How did it feel?
With anyone. Actually, I think it's the last time I've ever done that.
Too terrifying? Too raw?
No, I don't really care what anybody thinks.
You're allowed to say that, Kelly.
I don't feel the need to workshop a whole lot, really. I mean, you know, obviously when you have agents, they do it and they will give you feedback, but not that sort of detailed stuff. But whereas because it was a PhD and we just felt like we needed to get a bit more input, we're three very different writers, and that was great.
So that's one of the benefits of being in that teaching and learning community within a university. What kinds of things do you want your students to come out with when they've finished a writing course or a whole degree or a PhD when you supervise students? I know that's a, you know, worthy of a doctorate itself, that question, but, you know, in general, what kinds of things are you hoping that they leave you with?
Well, I think in terms of the PhD or master's, one of the things that happened for me is that it changed my practice forever. So I never... especially writing historical fiction, you do a lot of research, but any kind of writing, you do a bit of research. Now I understand things in a different way, and I understand the idea of research in a different way. So I've always done a lot of like political, economic kind of research,
mm-hmm.
like what are the conditions of the world that these people are in. But now I'm more likely to go to not necessarily really hard academic stuff, theoretical frameworks, but really look at how people have analysed that political moment or that economic moment or that moment in gender relations, whatever it might be that I'm thinking about. And so that depth of analysis, I think, is really important. Understanding how to access that for undergrads or postgrads, I think, is one of the most important, because it's an incredible tool to help you understand what you're doing, how you're doing it, because it can be about writing, not necessarily about history or the meaning. So I think that's one of the most important things. I think the other thing is just, and I see a lot of students, particularly undergrads, who just can't keep up with the reading or aren't particularly inspired to do reading. And I think that's a little bit sad. On one hand, they're particularly young people engaging with text in many more ways than I ever did on all these different media. And so in one way they have more confidence about using text. But on the other hand, you know, sometimes people, I was talking to a young filmmaker a little while ago and I said, well, who are your favourite filmmakers? And he said, oh, I don't watch film.
Whoa.
And some people who want to write say that they don't read much, but I just think that's a technical error apart from anything else. Yep. I just don't understand how you can see how things happen, how things work without really immersing yourself in whatever media it is that you want to produce.
Do you record, journal your reading? Like, do you just keep everything in your head, Cal? Or
when I'm doing research?
Research, but also your general kind of reading, I suppose. Yeah, how do you do those two separate things? Record?
Oh, no, I have no record of my general reading, and half the time I can't remember something a week later, which is probably not good. I used to put it all in library thing, but, you know, it's just falling apart.
Yep.
Research is different. Now I keep all my books and articles and everything. I keep all of that in note, properly organised.
Yep.
And if something is important enough to save, I'll put it in Evernote, like a web page or notes to myself or whatever. So I do organise my research materials very carefully, just not my general reading.
Okay. What are your rules for writing historical fiction for yourself?
My main rules would be not to put too much of your research in there, just to put a tiny percentage of your research in there, and particularly not try to cram it all in the first page.
I quote you chapter. So regularly when I work with students doing historical fiction. Well, I say, Kelly Gardner says, do your research, then leave it out.
it is a human thing. You just, especially when your first couple of books, I mean, I did it as well. The first couple of books, you have to get across where people are, you know, place the reader. You think, oh, I have to tell them what century it is.
Yeah.
But you don't. And so that is just something that even when you feel like you do it the first few times, actually, you're still doing it.
Yeah.
You think you're being restrained, but you're not.
But you're not.
Fantasy people are the same. Anybody who's done a lot of research or a lot of world building is going to want to convey
everything
as much, you know. You panic that the reader won't know where they are.
And look at all the work I did also.
Like, and it's so fascinating.
Exactly.
Let me tell you all about.
Let me tell you what I did.
It's like that, you know, the classic one is Hugo in Les Mis, where, you know, there's this dramatic, I mean, he was doing it intentionally, these diversions. So Valjean, you know, jumps over this wall. He's being chased. He jumps over this wall. You don't know what's on the other side of the wall, and it's a convent. And then you've got like 80 pages about the history of the convent. But he was consciously structuring it in that way. But that sort of can be how it feels, where somebody goes, oh, well, let me just briefly tell you about the history of this island that you've arrived on.
Yes.
So that's the main rule. And that is the main thing that you see in the first couple of books of people, the first few times people write historical fiction, that's the main mistake that they make, that we all make.
Put that in your notes, everybody. Kel, you've been shortlisted for a number of awards and won them as well. How have you dealt with success?
Have I got success? I mean, what does it even look like?
What does it look like for you?
I think now it's not about me. I think now it's about the book.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think that's how I felt at the beginning, because I thought,
the book was you.
Well, I mean, in a way, of course, every book is you. But when you start out, and it's particularly if your debut novel, you think that it is going to launch a career. And of course it does launch a career, but you don't know what that career looks like. That's where you start to have expectations that might be a little bit unrealistic, but you can't help it. Whereas now I think, so Brimstone I think is book 9, and I've got, you know, several others on the go. I think I just want the best thing for the book. So I had this conversation with somebody the other day because the Children's Book Council notables list came out.
Did.
And Brimstone wasn't on it. And I didn't care. I did not expect it to be on it. And I didn't care. Whereas other years, like for 1917, I would have been gutted if it wasn't on. Because I just felt like it was a really important book to have written at that moment about Australia and Australian young people. And therefore, it should have been notable.
Yeah.
Whereas Brimstone is so much fun, and I just want it to get into kids' hands.
Yep.
It doesn't.
So that the matter. Success is it getting to so the readers that you want it to get to.
So I think it's about, you know, so I think it's different. Obviously, I want every book to get into readers' hands, but some books are about having fun writing it, having fun researching it. Hopefully, people, in this case, kids, have fun reading it, and that's to me what matters the most. So that's my measure of success for these books. I mean, if they get shortlisted for something, fantastic, but I don't have any expectation of that.
That's a nice place to have got to.
It might
in
change
your career
completely.
For the next book. Kel, what advice can you give to debut novelists, to people just starting out in the world, in addition to all the advice you've already given us?
Well, I mean, I think the main thing is just that thing that we were talking about, is that you will think it's going to change your life. And of course it does change your life, but you don't know what that change will be like. And you can't take anybody else's model for that change and think it's going to be like that. I'm going to be J.K. Rowling, because, well, it's highly, highly, highly unlikely that you will be J.K. Rowling, but you might be somebody else. But the change that happens to you will be specific to you and your book, and there is no way of knowing what will happen. It might be the world's best book, and it comes out, you know, 2 months after another book that's got a similar cover or a similar theme, or
we can't something control just those happens. Things.
We can't control it, and you will try to control it. And I think, you know, you just do the best you can and know that it's not necessarily a failure of yours if your book doesn't get on the bestseller list, because just writing it is the only thing that you can do. You just have to make it the best book it can be that readers will love, and it will find those readers. And even if the number of those readers is smaller than you wanted, they love it, and that's the main thing. And you wrote it, and that's amazing. So it is about expectation management.
That's great advice. Kel, can you give us a recommendation for a debut novel from any time or place?
Yeah, so I was thinking about debut novels that I've read that have had a big impact on me. And one of the things that I remembered was being young. I was in that writing undergraduate course, and I read for the first time Monkey Grip, the debut novel of a young woman called Helen Gardner. And I think it's good to think about that and just think about, you know, everybody, even Helen Gardner, who is now, you know, many people would describe as a national treasure, and certainly one of the leading lights in Australian literature.
Absolutely.
Was once a debut novelist and had all the same feelings that everybody has. And pushback from critics, for example. And just remembering, I mean, I'm not quite old enough to remember when it came out, but I remember the feeling of reading it. And it would have been in the early 80s, say, when that world was still there. And I was surrounded by these people who were a lot like the people in Monkey Grip. And just the feeling of holding a novel in my hands that was set in my city, in a recognisable inner city. It's not recognisable now.
No.
But right then, you know, we all went to Fitzroy Pool, and we all, you know, went to the pubs, and, you know, and that gorgeous first line. I think it's something like, I can't remember it exactly, but it's something like, you know, battered old house on the corner of the street. We ate bacon every morning for every day of our lives, something like that. And it's just that placement and that feeling of reading something that was so, felt so emotionally true, as indeed it was. So it doesn't matter what your book is about, and it doesn't matter even necessarily if it's not the best book in the world, it will find its way into somebody's hands who really needed it. And that's the wonderful thing.
That is the wonderful thing. And I know that people will find those words very inspiring and warming as well. Thank you so much, Kelly, for speaking with us.
That's a pleasure.
Okay, Kelly, your first time quick five. For your first book, were you agented or unagented?
Not agented when I pitched, but agented when I did the contract.
Smart. Advance or no advance?
I got an advance, and the advance was for the whole trilogy.
Nice.
I think I got an advance for each book, but it was contracted.
And then you purchased a house in Paris after that kind of advance, right?
Yeah, or maybe I took somebody out for dinner, I don't know.
About that much.
Yeah.
Bottle of wine. Overseas territories or just Australia and New Zealand?
I was in New Zealand and they got New Zealand and Australia, sold it into Australia from there, and that was all.
Festival invites or no festival invites?
No, none there, and Australia ignored me on that book.
More fool you, Australia. And do you know how many copies sold?
I don't exactly know how many copies sold, but I earned out.
Great. Thank you very much.
That's a long time ago. I earned out. And they're still selling. They're now ebooks and they still sell, six a year or something.
Bless. We love those statements, right? Thank you, Kelly.
Pleasure.
For more on Kelly Gardner and her work and for show notes for this episode, head to thefirsttimepodcast.com. Let us know if you liked the app by sharing or giving us a rating wherever you listen. And you can get in touch with us via Twitter or Instagram at The First Time Pod. Thanks. You've been listening to The First Time Podcast, a podcast about the first and second time you publish a book. We recorded this episode at RMIT University on the traditional land of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation. This podcast is produced by Phoebe Ady. The First Time Podcast is supported by Writers Victoria, ACT Writers Centre, RMIT School of Media and Communication, and by our wonderful supporters on Patreon. You too can become a supporter of our podcast by heading to our Patreon site, www.patreon.com/thefirsttimepodcast.